A Birdificer creation.
Welcome to episode 156 of the Let's Talk Photography podcast. I'm your host, Bart Bouchotz, and this is the show for September 2026. I have a conversation for you this month, rather than one of the more common solo shows. Friend of the show and New Zealand photographer Alistair Jenks joins me to talk through a little epiphany he had, which he captured as a presentation that he named Becoming a Successful Photographer. And it's a very fun conversation. Alistair insisted that I wasn't allowed to peek. So the whole conversation was new to me as Alistair delivered it. There are accompanying slides that, they're not vital, but they are certainly nice to see the images we're talking about as we talk about them, particularly near the end of the presentation. You will find those linked in the show notes at let's-talk.ie. So without further ado, here is myself and Alistair's conversation. Alistair, thank you so much for coming back on to Let's Talk Photography, especially because you've done all the homework here. You literally sent me a message going, hey, I'd like to talk to you. It's like, okay, always a pleasure.
Well, yeah, it's great to be back. It's been a while. I mean, you know, you've had a lot of solo shows, but yeah, it's been something like 7 years since I've been on one.
We think 2017, yeah.
The data is difficult to pin down.
What is it you can't type, Alistair? So I owe you an apology for misspelling your name in the show notes, but I will correct that.
I'm used to it. The whole idea for this, it was a germ of an idea that I had, and I guess I thought it was a blog post, but I wasn't quite sure how I was going to structure it. And then I listened to your most recent, I think, Let's Talk Photography, where you talked about giving a presentation to the Naples Mac user group, and how you took a presentation, you created a presentation that was image heavy, and yet you managed to turn it into a podcast. And I thought, hey, I've kind of got an image heavy concept in my mind that I was trying to figure out. I wonder if it could be a presentation. Who would I present to? I know, maybe Bart would be interested. And so, yeah, I pitched you on the idea, and you seemed keen. So for your sins, here we go.
Indeed. And just for the audience, Alistair has refused to let me look ahead because he wants me to experience this de novo. So I have genuinely no idea what I'm going to experience here today with you all. So, yay.
Apart from the first page, which you did get a sneak peek at.
Well, true, the title screen is up and it's very pretty in Keynote. Oh, yes. Just, of course, like with when I did this, there will be a link to the slides at let's-talk.ie.
Yes, I've provided Bart with a PDF version that works well. So yeah, as I said, it was based on an idea that I had, which was itself based on an epiphany that I had recently. So the title of the presentation is How to Become a Successful Photographer. And that was the epiphany. It's just like, I am now happy to say to anybody, oh yes, I'm a successful photographer. But there's a trick to how I got to that point, and that's sort of what the presentation is about. So the subtitle is In Three Easy Steps, and there is an asterisk on easy, which we get on the next page. That's easy to remember, not easy to do.
So, yeah, the easier things are to say, Alistair, they're often less easy to do.
Yes, but if they're easy to say, they're easy to remember, and they're easy to constantly run around in your head to keep yourself on track.
That's true.
So we're going to go through those three steps tonight. not spending a heck of a lot of time on any one step. And as we'll discover, a lot of stuff you have already done, potentially multiple episodes on a lot of the detail of this, but I'm sort of collecting together everything that I think about in this context and in one place. So if you were game, you could probably put tons of links out to your previous episodes on some of these particular details. So without any further ado, we'll continue into step one, learn. And subtitle here, in which our hero dedicates a lifetime to the pursuit of knowledge. And I will note, when you're looking at this presentation, every single photo in here is one of mine. This photo is not particularly pertinent if you start reading some of the book titles. It was a photo I took through the window of our city central library many years ago because of the beautiful colouring, the sort of orange sodium lighting effect late in the evening. So, of course, I've produced it in black and white.
I was just going to say, there, Alistair, for a colour image, it looks distinctly monochrome. It's a lot of books. I'm not sure we see that these days, do we?
I can't get that. They've recently reopened our library, and I don't get that view anymore, which is sad because I like the view, just looking across shelves and shelves of books with people walking among them. Yeah. It was just one of those, you know, glance to my right as I was walking past and thought, ooh. But yeah, there's a reason why it's in black and white, and that will sort of get revealed in a later step. So, learning. First part, learning how to shoot. Now, I'll put the disclaimer up front here that I was until very recently this year a DSLR shooter. Now, I do shoot photos with my phone quite often. I have far more photos on my phone than I care to admit my commute is, you know, walking along a harbourfront, and I often do it around sunrise, and you're going to take photos. The other day I almost, but didn't quite succeed in getting a photo of a whale in the harbour.
Whoa.
So there's lots of photos.
And that's the thing, Alistair, right? Once you see like a photographer, if you have any capture device and something cool happens, you're going to take a photo. If it comes out, great. If it doesn't, oh well, at least you tried.
Yeah, I was running to the edge of the wharf. I mean, you walk out onto the waterfront and you see a whole lot of people standing there looking out over the harbour. It's like, something's happening.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I saw this. I think it was, somebody said it was a right whale. Pretty close in too, which does happen, which is kind of cool. But so this is focused around my, until recently, DSLR photography. I have just done a fairly major / expensive upgrade to a modern mirrorless interchangeable lens camera, MILC. But it's the same principles, right? It's just slightly different technology in play. And I thought through this because I know that you are completely, primarily, yeah, mostly a phone photographer these days. And I think most of this can apply to phone photography.
Well, I think your bullet points apply perfectly. The only difference will be where the settings are, exactly what the controls are, what the strengths are, and what the weaknesses are. Because the iPhone has weaknesses. It also has strengths.
Yeah. I mean, one of the strengths is that it's right there in your pocket, right?
So. Pretty big strength, yeah. But also the night mode and stuff, there are times when it will outperform, unless you happen to have a tripod in your pocket as well as your mirrorless camera. Oh. There are times the iPhone will outperform.
There's a point later where that will become quite pertinent, shall we say. So the bullet points here is in learning how to shoot is two main headings: understand your camera and understand your subjects. And under the topic of understanding your camera, I've said settings, controls, strengths, and weaknesses. So what your camera is and what it's good and bad at. And your subject, it's about behavior, lighting, space, and time. And that sounds a little Star Wars-y, but it's. I'll go to the next slide, and we'll see what I'm talking about there.
Just in terms of the controls, I think it was like Cartier-Bresson was like, you need to have the camera just be part of you. If you're thinking about how to take a photograph, you're missing the photograph. Whatever it is, you just have to be natural. You have to think what you want and your hands do what needs to happen. And there's only one way to get there, which is practice, 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 practice. And the understanding of your subject is so important. Butterflies, dragonflies are my two things. And they have behaviors. They seem random, but they're not if you understand them.
I mean, airplanes are a little bit easy to predict in general, you hope.
If you can listen into the ATC frequency, air traffic control frequency, they should be quite predictable.
Well, if you can see them, they generally follow a pretty defined path.
Hopefully.
Airplanes are easy, but swallows, tricky little things. Those things. I want to know how many G's they exert when they turn. It must be double figures.
Yeah.
So I've put together a couple of word clouds here on things that I sort of thought of in terms of learning your camera and learning your subject. So there's a bunch of terms there, but I've sort of highlighted in the larger text some of the ones that I have something a little bit more specific to talk about. So, and which people may not think about, and this again is from my personal experience, but certainly a lot of this does come into phone photography. The viewfinder. Right. Learn what you can get in your viewfinder. I've got a brand new camera, so I'm learning what I can get in there. With a DSLR, there was only so much you could get in there, but with a mirrorless camera or a phone, I actually was learning how to turn things off because there was too much. There's all these little symbols around there, and it's like, I know I need to see.
Yes.
Things like whether I've got rapid fire, servo mode or whatever they call it. Mm. I want to be able to see my basic settings, so aperture, shutter speed, ISO, especially learning a new camera. One of the cool things that I knew was available on the camera, and it's like, right, how can I get this, is you can get a live histogram in the viewfinder as you're shooting. It's like, yes.
Yeah.
So I can just glance up in the corner and think, oh, hang on, that's a little bit close to the top of the histogram there. Let me just dial that back a bit. So that's one, I think, with a phone. I don't know how customizable the Apple...
There are a few things you can turn on.
Camera app is.
One of the most important for me, because I seem to see the world lopsided, is the bloody level. At least have a chance of having it straight. Yep.
I'm really consistent on getting it exactly, I think it's 1.2 degrees off of level.
About that.
Without fail.
Yeah. maybe it's just the act of pushing the button knocks me slightly off in the same direction every time, but I'm pretty consistently not level.
No, because I can frame up a shot and then glance at the level because I had a level in my DSLR as well, and you think, oop, and then turn it before I've even pushed the button. So that's the first thing is you know, find out what you can put in your viewfinder because that can help an awful lot. I mean, the level, as you say, is a classic one, right? Because as they tend to say when talking about composition, it's like either be dead level or really lean into it. I'm quite literally in the case of being level. Yeah. But being 1 or 2 degrees off is really discordant to the viewer.
Yeah. The other one actually,
you can't water ski on lakes without a boat.
Yeah, and also water doesn't sit at an angle. That nature doesn't work like that.
Water skiing would be easier if it did.
True. Actually, you just go downhill. The other one is, I see in your word cloud, focus area. So in the iPhone, you can see where you're telling the iPhone to focus and you just tap to move that square around. That's really important, especially for macros and stuff where different things are at different distances. So there's the iPhone screen doesn't look cluttered, but there's actually quite a bit in there. Like you can do exposure compensation straight in there by tapping and sliding.
That. Yeah. because it always ruins those sunrises. It says,
right.
You know, it could be first light and there's a tinge of orange over the distant hills on the other side of the harbour, and it says, it's daylight. And it's like, no, it's not. Yeah. And I have to tap on the hills to make sure it stays focused there and then drag it down to say, no, it's almost dark.
Yeah.
Because the iPhone does tend to try and make everything into day.
Yes.
Another one, manual focus, which you've touched on with
manual of a sort.
The iPhone. It is manual of a sort, and you can say that, please. And where I find I use it on DSLR/mirrorless is not often, partly because I'm not very well practiced in this, but sometimes the automatic focus just won't.
Yeah, and you'll just grab the
manual focus.
Snap. Like
modern cameras, you can do a manual focus while it's auto-focusing, so you can just go, oi, go over there.
That away.
It may be selecting a point on the screen by touching your phone or by moving a joystick on your big camera, or it may just be grabbing a ring on the lens of a big camera and saying, go this way. Because one of the things I've discovered recently while learning about my new camera is apparently, and I don't know if this is true of phones, that cameras' focusing engines work better if you are focused too close. So if you're focused too close and then it has to find something that's further away, it'll do that a lot quicker than if you're focused too far away and it has to come closer. Don't know whether that's universal, but it seems to be true in my experience.
Yeah.
So, pre-focusing on something a little bit closer than you expect your subject to be if it's moving can actually be useful. Another one that I've got biggest in the cloud there, memory.
Yeah.
My previous camera had a very good feature here where you could pick and choose. When I turn the camera off, forget what I had set for exposure compensation. That's a good one. Because you can be in a situation, you think, oh, I need to be massively increasing the exposure here because the camera's just going to get it completely wrong. And then next time you pick it up and you go to shoot, and you, especially with the DSLR, where you don't see what the exposure is going to be necessarily.
Yeah.
And you take the photo and it comes out white. Yep. So there's certain things that you can tell the camera, forget this when I turn it off. And that's usually the things that I forget that I have turned on.
Yeah. And the iPhone hidden away in the settings app is basically a list of toggles for what it should and shouldn't remember. And I have basically not remembering my change of lens, not remembering exposure compensation, that kind of stuff, because I want to turn it on and get the 1X camera with nothing insane.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's very useful for being ready the next time you take a photo. So instead of like, oh, what was I doing last time, and having to back out of things or, you know, figure out everything. Whereas if you start in a default position, ideally something that's, you know, an average situation, like, you know, good light, but not super bright or super dark or anything like that. It's a very, very powerful capability. Another one, two really, that go hand in hand, shortcuts and button customization. Now, I think you can customize on the phone what the camera control does. I personally despise that camera control button for anything other than firing the shutter.
You can, Alistair. And to be honest, what you need to do is turn off half of camera control's features, which will then make the existing features usable without messing it up.
Yeah. So it's a case of, yeah, I mean, that's keep what you actually want to use and throw away everything you don't.
Yeah.
And in the case of the big camera, I mean, my new one, button customization, goodness me. I've followed a professional wildlife photographer because my main thing these days is birds. I mean, aviation's still a big thing, but I've really been pushing myself on birds. And this chap set up his camera with what he calls not back button focus, which is something I'd recently converted to on the DSLR, but triple back button focus. So one button uses the AI, find the animal and focus on it. One button says, focus on the point that I've selected. And one button, and I love this one, is, look, just, it's almost like that default mode. It's when you push that button, it sets the ISO low, it sets the shutter speed to something sensible, and lets you just take a, oh, here's a nice picture, photo, and then go back to your quick action mode. So the button customization, I mean, my new camera is a very high-end one, so I struggle. It took me, I think I went through his guide, setup guide. It took me 2 nights, so probably about 45 minutes to an hour each night going through it, and I haven't yet got to the video one. And it's taken me weeks of actually using it, and then I thought, you know what, I need to do this slightly differently for the way I want to shoot. So I've gone and I've made one change to how the buttons work, and I'll just work with that for a while. But setting up your camera to suit you is a big thing.
It's also a process, in my opinion. So you find a pain point, and then you address the pain point, and then you shoot like that for a while, and then you find another pain point, and you address that pain point. And when you run out of customization options, you're done.
Wait till we get to later slides, but
oh,
you've you'll see. So that's the camera, is learning your camera. So some of the key things there were, you know, what can you put on the viewfinder? What can you have the camera forget so that you don't? And, you know, the manual focus, the button customization, and there's a few other things there. Focus area, metering modes, the focus mode you touched on, learning menus in cameras. I mean, again, my current camera's got ridiculous numbers of menus, and I'm at the stage at the moment, I've had it for a few months now, and it's like, I know this option's there somewhere, and I can sometimes spend 10 minutes looking for it.
If it's important, you can't be doing that. Yeah.
Learning your subject, there's so many things here, and it depends on your subject. I mean, I was thinking about some of these aspects, and some of them do apply to landscapes, but you kind of have to think about it slightly differently. But if you're taking a photo of a thing, like a bird, like a plane, like a flower, like a butterfly, like a sculpture, a building, then most of these things are going to come into play. I mean, one of the smaller words, predictability. If you're taking a photo of a building, it's going to be pretty predictable. It's going to just be there. And anything you do is entirely down to you. But perspective. Now, this is something I know full well. I remember some of your stuff about perspective in probably quite early Let's Talk Photographies. And I specifically remember you had a series of shots of, was it Carton House or something in the grounds there, where you had the building taking up the same amount of the frame, I think it was, but you went from super wide angle to super telephoto, and the foreground and background changed so much, even though the building was the same size.
I don't remember what I did, but I know I did that, because that to me was one of those aha moments. It's like, wait a second, I have separate control over the subject and the background/foreground.
That's
very powerful.
And until you see it, you don't realize just how much of a difference it makes. You know, it can turn here's a photo of a thing to here's a photo of a thing.
Or a thing in a place? Because sometimes the place is a distraction, and sometimes the place is part of the story. Well, that's just influenced your choice.
Yes, yeah. And the angles you get too. Like if you're standing in front of a building with a wide angle, you're not going to see what's down the side of the building, which might be useful if it's a lean-to, a ramshackle, you know, lean-to firewood storage area. But if, on the other hand, there's some beautiful lighting down there, then you might want to get back so that you can actually see down the sides of the house. So that's a big one. More so for those things like buildings and, you know, what, trees. I mean, slightly different situation, but they don't tend to move much unless they're Ents, I suppose. But part kind of hand in hand with that, and it's one of the larger words on my word cloud, is story. And I've got notes here, and it's learn how to take more than a static image. And that is basically either portray what has happened or what will happen. And the classic one is with wildlife. If you have a photo of, let's say, one of the big cats, and it is standing with a stalking pose and staring. If you just take a photo of the, let's call it a lion, then it's going to be a photo of a lion standing there. But if you recompose that so that the lion's on one side of the frame and looking clear across an empty frame, that's telling the story that there's something over there. Like there's nothing right in front of it. There's something over there. It's spotted it. It's thinking about what it's going to do next. So thinking about that story aspect, and particularly in wildlife, is what is the animal's behavior. But even with like a tree, you know, if it's springtime and the tree's in full leaf, it's like, okay, fine. You can see that it's in full leaf, but maybe it's an evergreen. But if you could get a bright spring flower in the foreground, or even just tiny, you know, somewhere in the frame, that tells the story of it's coming into its full spring bloom kind of thing. There's probably there's probably billions of ways that you can portray what has happened or what will happen, and it makes such a difference. I've had some photos that have really, really just picked up on that. It's not just a photo of a thing, it's a photo of something happening.
And that's just practice, I think, of figuring out how to see the bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, you can sort of think of these things, but until you actually try it and then you think, oh, actually, that worked really well. That looks, you know, if you see tension in the final frame, then you've probably achieved story.
Yeah.
Now, another one, and this is a technical term, but it's not what I'm meaning here, because it's in the subject learning, and it's dynamic range, which is, it's about how to flatter your subject with, in comparison, and you actually touched on it before, is, you know, the background might be so a superb setting. Like, you know, if you've got one of those big fluffy cloud skies with sunrise or sunset colors and a beautiful building or tree in the front, then the dynamic range of that is the subject versus its grandiose setting. But it might be something else, like it might be a close setting, but you still need to make sure that your subject is the subject and it's not just in the frame.
Yes.
The worst thing that I've found for that is a brown bird in brownish green foliage at close range. So, okay.
What do we do here?
The bird. I can see that there's a bird there, and I can see the bird really well, and there's nothing obscuring any key part of the bird. But if you, and here's the key I found, look at it as a thumbnail. And if you just see a square of greeny brown stuff, then that's lacking the dynamic range, and it's not. I mean, it might be a useful photo saying, here's a photo of this bird so that people can see the bird. But in terms of a piece of art, it just doesn't work. Now, there are tricks which I'll touch on later that you can, and I have used, to kind of dig yourself out of that a wee bit, but there's only so much you can do. So the trick is to find a way to sit the subject in the scene so that the subject is, as I said, the subject and not just, you know, another part of that monotonous amount of color that's in there. Yeah. I've had some great photos of birds that are just because there's no distinction between the bird and the background.
If you squint and the photo becomes one thing, it's missing something, whether it's color or lighting. Something has to happen so that the shapes are there.
And it may even just be recropping it to a different.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't often do a heck of a lot, but it can help. One of the key things that I use for that, and even after I've gone through a batch of photos and edited them, always look at a grid of thumbnails. And sometimes you'll see, oh, what was I thinking there? And you suddenly realize that the white balance is way off.
And actually, that's a good thing as well.
Re-edit it.
That's a great tip, actually, because if they're all supposed to look vaguely the same and you zoom out into the grid and one of them looks completely the wrong color tone or whatever, it's like, ooh, that one's wrong.
I've found sometimes a frame will be the wrong color, but more commonly I'll look at it and think, why is that so dark? And even staring at the histogram and trying to adjust the color, and you know, I mean, adjusting your screen can help when you get to the editing, and we'll touch on that a wee bit in a bit. But yeah, looking at it as a thumbnail, you get to see this is the hole at a quick glance. And if you don't see something, then yeah, there's work to be done, or maybe that's just not one that ends up seeing the light of day. Yeah, well, I mean, you can keep it, but whether you'll, you know, gussy it up and share it with everybody is another thing.
Right.
And part of that is another one of the items in the word cloud is the light angle.
Yeah.
You know, in wildlife photography, it's generally the light behind you, but one of the important things is the light is low, because at midday it's so extreme, you know, particularly in the middle of summer, that the technical term now, dynamic range between the harsh bright sun on a, you know, a light part of your subject versus the shadow that very subject may be casting is way too much for your camera to handle. Now the iPhone will try and help you with that and ironing that out, but even then it can still be such a huge thing. So getting a low sun angle can help a lot, and it also often just looks nicer because it's a warmer light. So it's, you know,
well, also generally you tend to have more useful shadows. Like a midday sun tends to cast like shadows that don't actually look, they don't add a sense of depth to the shot compared to a low shadow. It's just a
black spot on the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess the final one I'll bring up here is uniqueness.
I hope that would.
is to think about, I mean, you know, one of the things you hear is people say, if you're going to take photos of children or pets, get down to their level, because the standard human height, in fact, I think you might have talked about this recently as well, just looks boring. But for example, if there's, you imagine a daisy in a recently cut grass, certainly with an iPhone it's possible. What happens if you put the lens below the flower head looking up?
Yeah.
You know, that's a unique angle that, you know, nothing but small insects might see. Even they may not see it if they're landing on the flower. So, you know, and that can affect your lighting. I mean, if you've got a big, bright midday sky, that's potentially not going to work. But, you know, if there's a sunset sky there and you can get just sky behind this flower head, maybe that's quite a compelling shot.
And actually, it's interesting there, because when I was thinking uniqueness, I was thinking of uniqueness of the subject. But if the subject is not particularly unique, like the daisy example, then if the subject isn't the source of uniqueness, then something else can be. So a mundane subject can make a really unique image. Hadn't quite twigged that.
Well, I mean, the reason I thought of that example is I do have a photo, not in the presentation, of a daisy on my back lawn, which is not a particularly nice lawn, or at least it wasn't then. And it was the last daisy of the season. And I got right down at the tippy top of the blades of grass and shot it with an extremely shallow depth of field. So all there is this green, there's a sort of a indistinct brown in the background for a fence, and this single bedraggled looking daisy standing up right in the middle of the frame. It's actually, you know, it's quite emotive. It's like, oh wow, that's, you know, that's the end of something.
Yeah, but back to your story, Alistair.
The flower. Yeah, it's just the flower. There's nothing else that's stealing the show. But yeah, that was getting right down to the literally putting the camera on the grass, lifting it up only enough to that I didn't have blades sticking out right in front of the lens. So, yeah, uniqueness of subject for sure. But, yeah, you can often take the boring and make it unique by just considering the angle, the lighting, what else you put in the scene, etc. So there's a bunch of words on there that you can look at and think about, that we've touched on kind of most of them. So moving on, this I think is something that a lot of people don't understand, or they might say, oh, I don't know how to do that, it's too hard. And my message here is, Yes, I agree. It's too hard if you expect to be able to achieve everything straight away.
Yeah.
Were you a good photographer the first time you picked up a camera, or were you just shooting, you know, stuff that you would now look at and think, ugh, I was an amateur back then?
Yeah, the same goes for editing.
Practice. Yeah. And so I've called out some key things here that are sort of very, very high level. Four basic things that I always consider. So the first one is setting a baseline. And again, this possibly doesn't apply to a phone. This is probably the main area where it doesn't, but I always shoot in RAW. I have now for, well, since I caught myself out with going back to the earlier thing about what will your camera remember when you turn it back on after turning it off. I was at an air show. I had exposure compensation dialed in because I needed it for a bright sky to get the aircraft properly exposed. And I was, I think it was about 17 frames into several hundred that I shot that day. Oh, the battery's run out. So I did a quick change of the battery and I carried on, and it forgot that exposure compensation. And every other frame of the day was massively underexposed, but they were raw.
Yeah, now, so yeah, with JPEGs,
it was game over. They weren't brilliant as raw, but they were, many of them were workable. Where the camera had made a close to okay, exposure, you know, selection, then they were quite usable. But even the others were like, it wasn't a great photo, but it was a photo, and it's like, yeah, I can publish that. It's not my best work, but it works. But yeah, I had hundreds of underexposed photos, and only because they were raw did I get to rescue anything out of that. I was gutted when I found out what had happened, and that's why it is burned into my memory about what is the camera going to remember, what do I need to do. And frankly, with a mirrorless camera where you can tell it, show me the exposure you're actually going to use, and a phone will do this by default. Yeah. It's such a savior in situations like this.
It does.
Because you can look at it and think, why is it everything so dark? Oh,
yeah.
And, you know, you might still miss a shot if something was happening when you discovered this, but you're not going to spend the rest of the day taking ridiculously underexposed. I think most of them I had to increase by two stops to make them anywhere near usable.
Yeah. Well, we've all done it, Alistair, because I discovered how to do a batch edit when I played that little trick on myself. I was like, well, I'm not going to do this every time. Select all, increase exposure by, I think in my case was one stop, but yeah.
Yeah, not as bad as the time that I grabbed I had two camera bodies and I thought, I'll grab the small one because it's easier to carry. And I went quite some way to visit a railway museum, and there's all sorts of interesting stuff here. And I was taking a whole bunch of photos, and I got home and discovered there was no card in the camera.
That
you can't solve. You can on my current camera. It has a setting that says do not fire the shutter if you don't have a card. So it will become obvious very quickly. Yeah. It doesn't help if the card is back in the car and it's, you know, 15 minutes walk away.
It'll manage your disappointment.
Yes. So the baseline, shooting in RAW, if you have a camera that's capable of doing that. I've also mentioned noise reduction, because these days modern cameras are pretty good with the noise, but the software is amazing. Now, I'm a huge fan, and I'll make no excuses for using DxO Photo Lab. You can also use DxO Pure RAW, which is sort of a pre-processing and then edit it in, you know, Lightroom or whatever other, even Apple Photos if you want. But it does an incredible job of getting rid of noise without losing detail. I've taken photos in museums, and you know what museum lighting is like. Handheld, I think it was a fairly wide angle, but I think the aperture was f5.6, and it was like as low as I dared to go on the shutter speed. So there was a ton of noise, and I've got these beautiful, crisp, clear photos as a result. So that's setting a baseline that says you've actually got something to work with. And lens correction is the other thing that DxO do exceptionally well. In Lightroom, for example, it'll, you know, adjust for vignetting, it'll adjust for distortion, you know, barrel or pin cushion distortion, etc. But DxO go a step further. They actually test every lens on every camera in a lab. They take several thousand photos with each combination, and they measure what happens in terms of chromatic aberrations, and the key thing is sharpness. I have a lens that I didn't use for years because the edges were just mush. And I bought that long before I had DxO software, and I just put through photos that I took in 2008, I think is the earliest camera that it supports. And I put photos through that, taken with that horrible lens, and it looked great. Yeah, you know, I used to think, oh, this lens takes horrible photos. No, it doesn't. It just needed the right treatment afterwards.
Yeah.
So that's the baseline, is you can deal with noise. You can deal with soft lenses. And honestly, DxO, I mean, give it a try. You can get a 31-day free trial for either of those products. And it's, if you're using, it has to be a supported camera, but they do support an awful lot, especially if you've got anything, you know, relatively new. That, for me, is the baseline. I've got a preset that just does those things automatically. Yeah. Next one, light and color. And the sub point that I've got here is black is black, white is white. And this is a trick that I learned from a wildlife photo processing course that I bought that I really, really enjoyed. And he just said a simple thing. He said, if you've got a photo of a bird that's black and white, and you know it's a black and white bird, make sure it's got black and white in the photo and not just shades of gray.
Yes.
And I thought, that's a good point. And then I looked at some of my older photos and I thought, ooh, you know, and you can put the cursor over it and see what it is. And, you know, you should get close to not exactly 000 for the black, but I was seeing like things in the 30s and 40s. Yeah. And then you go to the white where you should get 255s. And I had like 210s and it's like, oh. And I tell you what, when you make black as black and white as white, it looks so much better.
Absolutely.
And I've even used that with my aviation shots. You know, Air New Zealand, our local airline, their color scheme is black and white. Guess what I do now?
Black is black.
Like, you know, push that white so that, you know, if there's a sun glinting off it, let that clip. But, yeah. You know, don't clip it in too many places or for too much area, and then get that black nice and low, but, and you know, not so low that you can't see the shine and things like that. And they look so much better. And you know, another one is white balance, but that is a tough thing to tame.
Black
is,
art.
That's my experience. A white art, perhaps a white balanced art. It's great if you have a known neutral. Like a white painted airliner generally is truly white.
Yes.
Easy. But even then, sometimes you go, right, that's white. And then you, oh, what happened there? And there's some trick of lighting. And the other thing to realize that if you take a photo at sunset, the whites don't actually look white. So if you white balance it, it looks completely wrong.
Yeah, they shouldn't look white. It's bloody well sunset. They should look orange.
Yeah. So, yeah, white balance is a pain in the neck, but the black is black and white is white. Just that makes an enormous difference to the quality of your photo. Third point, local adjustments. Now, these are sometimes called masking and things like that, but what it is making adjustments to part of the photo. And I find, possibly because I'm shooting raw, but I find that this is not, I don't use it for every photo, but I use it for an awful lot, probably more than half. Sometimes the situation, the dynamic range of the scene that I talked about before is okay and it works and you don't need to do local adjustments. But when I talked about that bird in the foliage that didn't stand out, I isolated the bird. I made it a bit brighter. I made the contrast a bit stronger. I mean, this bird is a sort of, it's not nondescript brown, it's kind of flecked. So it's got quite a pale brown breast, and then it's got flecks through it, and then the back is a darker brown with paler bits through it. So you can push that contrast up, but don't push the contrast up on the very, very finely, what's the word? The branches are, you know, maybe a millimeter thick. And there's hundreds and hundreds or thousands of these branches. And if you turn the contrast up on that, you're just going to lose the bird again. So what I would do there is I would slightly brighten the bird, and then I might slightly darken the bush, and maybe turn the contrast down on the bush so that there's not lots of light and dark coming from the background. And it's not lying. It's just because when you look at a scene, your brain will pick the bird out anyway.
Right.
And you probably won't even be seeing the bush. So the fact that your camera just says, yep, this is everything that, that all of the photons that arrived in the rectangle is not the truth as such.
Right. And it's not a, you're not a journalist who has to capture the truly raw image. You're creating art here. So I don't think there's anything to apologize for by to emphasize the subject.
Yeah. And one of the ones I do quite often for non-wildlife, and in some wildlife ones, is attack the sky. It can be too bright, it can be too dark, it can be too blue, it can be not blue enough, or, you know, not contrasty enough or too contrasty. And you can attack the sky and either make it stand out, like a, you know, I have a photo of some pretty intense-looking clouds over the sea, and the photo is of the clouds. So I actually de-emphasized the sea a wee bit and made the clouds really textured to, you know, show that this, it was basically a massive rain cloud that was very, very tall and fluffy looking, you know, bright sun on the outside, but deep gray underneath. So play up that contrast, but at the same time, don't ruin the contrast that's on the water that might make it just look crunchy. So yeah,
and mixed white balance is a big one for local adjustment, because particularly with my railway photography, the train is literally on a track. I don't get to decide how it's going to be lit. It is there. If it's a steam train that comes by once a year, there it is. And you actually encouraged me to get to grips with local adjustments while editing on the iPhone, which you can't do in Apple Photos. So that means I'm now becoming really quite comfortable with full Lightroom on the iPhone, because I'm still editing on the iPhone, but and that was your encouragement, frankly, and it's made a big difference, because you know when you do a local adjustment well, you can't tell it was a local adjustment. So people probably don't realize there's ever more local adjustments in what I'm posting, but there is.
Well, and the photo that caused me to mention that to you was, I think it was a black steam loco, and it was running tender first, and the locomotive itself looked fantastic, but the tender had sort of overlapped with a dark bush, and it was just sort of becoming indistinct on the tender, and it's like, well, the tender's part of the engine, it's a critical piece of the picture, so you just needed to just push that bush away, maybe lighten the bush and keep the tender nice and black, and you know, just tease a little bit, because again, when you were there, you saw the tender. You didn't. Oh, where did the half of the tender go? It disappeared. No, it didn't. It was perfectly obvious. I mean, partly because it was moving, I guess, but even if it parked there, you would still see it.
Yeah.
So you're sort of adapting for the fact that you've got this single plane of light that was, you know, just a bunch of photons that were arriving at the time. The final bullet point on how to edit is finishing.
Yeah.
I mean, number one, do finish it. Do put it somewhere. Do share it. A lot of people take photos. I'm the same on my phone. I've got probably countless thousands of photos that no one else has ever seen, and half the time I don't see. But I've put three subpoints here: size, color, branding. I have, for the longest time, been using a 24, then 25 megapixel DSLR. I now have a 45 megapixel mirrorless camera. Great possibilities for cropping in quite deeply there, because I have been publishing for the longest time 6 megapixels. So that has always given me plenty of latitude for cropping without sort of, you know, ending up with something that looks relatively tiny. And for the longest time, I actually said I'm doing it this many pixels wide. And I go back to some of my earliest Flickr photos, which was only, I think, less than 2 years into Flickr's life. And they're a massive, like 1,200 pixels wide. And now look at that thing. That's like a postage stamp or postcard, maybe. And then I started, you know, I went from 1,200 to 1,600, and then I went to, you know, 3,000 or something rather. No, not 3,000. I didn't go that high, but I was doing the length of a side started off doing the width, and that doesn't work when you got vertical. So I said, okay, the longer side, well, that doesn't work when you got square. And then I figured out that in PhotoLab, one of the options for resizing is megapixels. It's like, I don't have to do the calculations anymore. I can crop to any shape that I like, and it outputs a roughly 6 megapixel image. So perceptually, they are all the same size, and that's what I share. And a key thing there is secret. It can hide some of the problems for the not quite so great photos, because by the time you shrink it down, it's sort of just not such, you know, if you've got some still heavy noise, shrinking it from, let's say, 20 megapixels to 6, it gets rid of a lot of the problem.
Yeah. And that's still plenty also, for everyone's screen, right? So I think you shouldn't share the full resolution. It's not nice for people viewing the images, actually, because they're not going to be pinching and zooming to infinity. And it's just a waste of everyone's bandwidth.
Yeah. And the other thing is branding. And I mean, I've just created a Mac app using Claude AI to do this when I'm not in PhotoLab, because PhotoLab has this great feature where you can put the watermark on the photo, on the photo, as you're editing it. And the key thing for me is I long ago figured out that watermarking a photo does not stop somebody stealing it. Some people will steal it and publish it as their own, even with your watermark still on there. But these days, it's easy to get rid of them. But what you can do is put your branding on there so that honest people can see who it is. And, you know, in my case, I've got a web address there and they can go and look for more. But the trick for those is I make them subtle, and therefore I tune each one to each image. So I've got a couple of presets that I start with. I've got a black one and I've got a white one, and I've got a standard sort of size that I use. But I will put a black or a white one, usually top center or bottom center. Occasionally it has to go in a corner. But then I will just turn the opacity down until it's definitely readable, but it doesn't jump out at you and say, watermark. So that's...
Yeah. It is a balance there.
I've come to that over many years. It's like, it's there, and if you go looking for it, you will find it, but it's not screaming at you. Like some people put, you know, this thing, massive thing in the middle, and it's like, well, you've just ruined the photo. So, yeah. And color is, make it sRGB. I mean, if you're using glass, you can put it on in some other color space and people will see it. But even then, only if they've got the appropriate screen. Color's a whole thing. If you convert it to sRGB, if you really care about color, use soft proofing modes if your software has it.
But it has to fall back. I actually kind of prefer to share with the high dynamic range and stuff, but it has to fall back.
Yeah, and sometimes if you let the systems do the fallback, they don't do a great job and you end up with a pretty flat, boring-looking image.
Yeah, I spent pretty much all of this week trying to figure out how to make Lightroom make the SD preview not suck, because I had an image that really needed the HDR for anyone whose screen can do it, because it just sings. It's an amazing image when HDR is available, but the SD render was horrific. I eventually managed to tame it on edit number 5. It took a lot of YouTube video watching, but I got there.
Yeah, and I think the key thing is to think about the color. And ultimately, you know, when you export the final edit to a separate photo, look at the export, because that's what you're actually going to be sharing. Don't trust what you've seen on the screen while you're editing.
Yes.
Look at what was actually produced. And sometimes I've done that and I've looked and I thought, whoa, and I've got, you know, I've had high sharpening on for photos of big things or distant things. And then I've got a hill covered in grass with a parasailer who had been attempting to take off and hadn't succeeded. So it was, you know, a lovely little scene, but the grass was so sharp that you could literally count the blades, and it's like, no, that's too much. I need to go back and fix the sharpening, tone it down a bit. Yeah. But I couldn't see that when I was editing it. It was only when I actually exported it to my target size, and I thought, no, that's not going to work. And same with the overall sharpness of basic objects can sometimes look a bit off or a bit soft or sharp, etc.
Like I find, actually look at it on the social media or the website you're posting to, because that's what people see, not what you saw. And it is worth that little sanity check of just
looking. Okay, it's on Flickr. Oh, okay, it's fine here.
So, moving on, because we've been taking a while here. Step two, this is going to be a quick one. Practice, in which our hero commits to a lifetime in pursuit of unobtainable perfection. Always strive for perfection, knowing, of course, that you will never get there.
Yes.
And really, this is a simple slide. Define one problem and conquer it, which means go back to learning and then keep trying until you don't have to think about it.
Yes.
Then repeat, because there is always another problem that you can go and find and practice that. But do it one at a time, because if you think, oh, I need to change these six things, and you go out and you try shooting photos and it's like, wait, no, and you will forget them. But if you pick one, like, I can't think of an example, but why do my photos always have this problem? Let's say you keep choosing too slow a shutter speed. Well,
yeah.
My next task is to go out there and think about getting that shutter speed high enough. Like, right, okay, it's a small bird. It's moving fast. I need to get above 1/2000th of a second. Think about that. Think about that. Eventually, you'll get to the point where you will go out and think small bird, and you'll just, without thinking, you'll just change the shutter speed to, you know, 2,400 or 500 or whatever it is. And then you can move on and think, right, what else am I doing? Well, I keep underexposing it. Okay, we'll go out and then concentrate on the exposure, because now your shutter speed selection is ingrained. So that's not a problem.
But as you go through your journey, Alistair, you're going to end up moving from very practical things like you just described to being more artistic in what it is that you're trying to improve, because your pain point is going to shift from getting the capture right to getting the composition right, you know, to getting the feel right. And yeah, over time, you just, whatever you're weakest at, focus on it for a while until you don't feel it's your weakest point. Then there'll be something else.
And if you have trouble succeeding on that, pick something else for a while so that you can sort of come back at it fresh later on, because you don't want it to get stuck and then think, oh, I'll never solve this. Just go solve something else and then come back. And yes, the next slide. No, really, pick another problem.
Brilliant.
They will never run out. I can guarantee you. Yeah. I've been shooting for 40 years. it's taken me a while.
There's always a weakest point. Okay. There's always something you can be better at, because like you said, perfection is impossible. And I think the moment you tell yourself you're done, but not in the good way.
So now step three, which is where the epiphany came.
Okay.
Define success, in which our hero stops to smell the flowers at their feet. And you may see now why I had the heading photos previously in black and white.
Yes.
Because that image, I mean, on an Apple screen, I don't know if it translates through our screen sharing, but on an Apple screen, that image just punches you in the face with the color. And that was a deliberate thing. That was a field of tulips in, of all places, Singapore.
Oh.
In the flower dome. Definitely worth a visit. They've got all sorts of amazing things. They have a themed exhibit in the center. It changes, I think, several times a year. And on my first visit there, the theme was tulips. And they had a little replica Dutch windmill and tulips and wooden cows. It was quite a lovely scene. But this field of tulips with this intensely bright yellow. Some people will say that I've overdone the saturation there, that they weren't really that yellow. And it's, no, you're probably right. They probably weren't. But if you were able to be there at just the right time of day when the sun was at just the right angle, maybe it would have looked like that. And
my answer to that criticism, Alistair, is that's what it felt like. It felt in your face.
Yes. And that, I mean, this is a square crop of the middle of a shot. There's a whole 3x2, or maybe 16x9, and it's just this field of flowers. I'm not sure if that's the full height. No, it's not. It's about half to two-thirds of the height, and then 16x9 wide. There's just heaps of these flowers, and I find it absolutely delightful. So, defining success. Here's the epiphany. Success is yours to define.
Yeah.
It's probably not making a living. It's probably not awards. It's probably not even a claim. It is almost certainly Dun, dun, dun. What makes you happy?
Amen. That was, I cannot underline enough how much I agree, Alistair.
That was my epiphany. And in fact, that photo that sits beneath those words, what makes you happy, is one of my current desktops. I have virtual desktops on my beautiful, gorgeous Apple Studio display, which really gives you great color and high definition. And here's the thing. I find myself sometimes getting rid of all of the windows on the screen and just sitting there and staring at it. Now, this photo was actually completely random. It was absolutely not sought. It was taken, it was the last photo I took, certainly with my big camera, on our holiday, which was Singapore and Japan, in that order. It was taken at Narita Airport as we sat in the bar waiting for our plane to board to go home.
Okay, and so that is runway painting capturing the setting sun.
Yeah, so there's that little bit of detail in the foreground. You can see there's I kind of wish that contrail wasn't there, because it's just, or that there was another one that made it symmetrical, or it went like that. But I mean, it adds interest. But the light, just as we, you know, because when we sat down at this bar, it was, the sun was still sort of just above the horizon, but we just sort of watched it slowly sink. We had a couple of hours to kill before the boarding call, and we just watched it slowly sink, and these colors just developed in the sky. And I've spent a considerable time, you know, those editing things about getting the color and the black and white. There is detail in the foreground.
Yeah, and there's enough, Alistair,
really,
because
want you to see that.
Fascinated by the shapes. That's kind of the cool thing with painted runway lines, is they have shapes.
Yeah, and it's quite a nice little sort of sweeping. I mean, if you looked straight down on it, it'll be two semicircular arcs or similar with some other thing going through the middle of it. But it just looks like these sweeping lines, which sort of just adds that little bit of interest to the foreground. I have another similar photo that's got I've left a little bit more light in the foreground because there's a Airbus A380 in the middle of it that's just barely lit.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, adds a mood. But this one, that sky, that was just at the perfect moment. Yeah. And yeah, that's one of the ones that I would just clear the windows off and I would just stare into that sky. And there's nothing to actually look at. There's nothing that sort of jumps out. I suppose the tree line on the far side of the runway and there's a hill line behind that. But just those colours, you know, it just makes me happy.
It's a feel. It's a shot that just captures a feel rather than the subject is all of it. The subject is the whole setting.
Yeah. Exactly. And so on that theme of things I have on my desktop that I sometimes just stare at, these are my current, I actually have some variation based on the time of day, but these are the ones that I have. When I first came up with this idea, these were the four that I had. Some of them change a wee bit. So these four photos are ones that I will I have them on the studio display. When I'm working from home and I have my studio display connected to a ThinkPad, I still have the Mac sitting beside me, and the MacBook Pro screen is even better. And I just leave one of these on that screen, just sitting there. I mean, I do use the MacBook Pro for the odd thing during the day, but I will just have one of these photos just sitting there. I'll just look across at it. So I'm just going to go through these four with a little bit of detail as to how I've put the learning of, you know, the camera, the subject and the editing to practice in these photos. So from the top left, the first one is what they call the downtown core in Singapore. So that's the famous Marina Bay in the foreground with that beautiful green water. The iconic hotel that bears the name of the bay is essentially behind me at that point. This was the only time when traveling that I specifically went somewhere to take specific photos. And I've actually got a panorama version of this that this is part of. So it goes further around to the right with more buildings around the head of the bay. But if we sort of look at the detail, this is what I love about this shot. When you zoom in, and we'll see the full thing, full screen in a moment, there is so much detail in there. All these man-made straight lines, of the window frames and the architectural features on all of the buildings. And the irony is that there's so much detail, and I made sure that it was all pin sharp, even at full size, that it's actually simple because it's just lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of lines. You don't have to look at all these different shapes. It's just, here's all the lines on this building, here's all the lines on this building, and there's different colors and different patterns of lines, but it's just, it's about the detail. And the color is okay, and I'll bring up the full photo now. I spent time making sure that the color of the water and the color of the trees and the color of the sky sort of didn't steal from the buildings, because the ones on the left have obviously got a sort of a more black tone, and then as you go right, they've got some gray and green and white. And that's sort of interesting in itself. And that one just left of center that looks like a Minecraft thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. But yeah, it was a very careful case, and you can see that I've done the perspective correction because the buildings on the far left and the far right are both vertical. Because that worked in this situation, I was far enough away.
I'd say vital, Alistair, because buildings don't lean unless they're in Pisa.
Yes. And these would be leaning towards each other, which would be a concern.
Yeah.
But so what I love about that, I mean, I love the overall sort of aqua tone of it, you know, from green to blue, from water to sky, and the buildings kind of build into that. And
but they bridge right? Because there is blue tones in some buildings.
Yeah, the row of trees beneath, which are lovely shade in the heat of Singapore, I can tell you that. they sort of add a sort of a vibrance to break between the water and the buildings.
That's true, actually. That's a little piece of nature to break up the very, very rigid lines.
Yeah, because most of the buildings don't stop. They just sort of disappear behind the trees. And then you've got the waterfront with the water. And so, yeah, that's a very deliberate photo taken, you know, and I walked around until I got the perfect point, perfect spot with not too much in front of me on the water. I mean, there's that thing on the left, but I couldn't really get rid of.
It's not distracting because it's at the edge.
Yeah, and close enough that they seemed towering, but far enough away that I could fit them all in easily, etc. And then, yeah, the edit was just being careful with the blues and the greens and making sure it was pin sharp everywhere and perfectly vertical side to side. So I absolutely love staring at that one. One thing not to try is counting windows. It's too hard. There's so many floors. I couldn't even count the floors on most of them. You kind of almost have to, you know, I mean, you move your mouse pointer up and it's, oh, I moved the mouse pointer too far. I don't know where I was up to. So that's one of them. And then moving on to the next one was also in Singapore. This, believe it or not, was the view from our hotel room window. Nice. That was half the trip. It was half of the trip for us. My wife and I got upgraded. We didn't ask for it. We were just told, oh, you've been upgraded to a premium room. Okay.
Ooh.
And we got out of the lift lobby and there's floor-to-ceiling windows in front of the lifts. And we thought, wow, that's a pretty impressive view. And then we were looking, right, where's our room? Oh, and our room was right beside the windows. So we had the same view.
Cool.
And this one was actually a deliberate attempt that I hadn't really tried before. Well, I had tried, but not consciously, to get light trails from the cars on the road below. So it's a night scene for those listening if you haven't looked at the presentation yet. So that was kind of the goal. But what I realized was, you know, that was easier with a very, very wide angle. And then I thought, there's just so much in that scene. And kind of like the buildings, there's a lot of detail in there, but in this case, there's all sorts of different details. So if we bring that one up large, you can see, in fact, if you know what you're looking at, you can see all sorts of icons of Singapore. There's several hotels. Right down at the bottom, you can see a swimming pool.
Oh, yeah.
That's the world-famous Raffles Hotel. If you're made of money, you might wish to stay there. Beyond that is the Suntec shopping center with I think there's a hotel in that tower that comes out of that, and it's got those amazing lights that run up the side and those big straight lines. Although most of the broken lights were out of the top of the frame there. You can see there's one broken light there. You then get the Pan Pacific Hotel in the background with its sort of control towery thing on the side and the nice light up sign. There's a little gap and you can see a wheel. That's the Singapore Flyer. There's a building with some beautiful red lighting on the bottom. To the right of that is actually the sea.
Yeah.
And there's actually ships there. And then there's some more hotels. Then you can see the blue lighting. That's the Marina Bay Hotel, the iconic ship-shaped one. And very difficult to see in the dark. But between that blue hotel and the kind of nondescript block to its left are the super trees. We got to watch the light show every night twice
from
our hotel room. Well, it was kind of distant and you couldn't really see a lot. You could see that there were moving lights. And yeah, just all of these differently lit buildings and different colors. The moon is actually hiding up on the left there somewhere, but not very clearly in this shot. And that was all set from, I want to do light trails, and I set the camera up on cushions in the window, and we turned off all the room lights so we didn't get any reflection. And then I thought, well, if it's going to be wide angle, let's make sure that there's something interesting in it.
Yeah. And it sort of reminds me of like a Bruegel painting. Just so much life is just happening through the scene. You know, is that a little taxi? Is that a little police car? Someone arriving in the hotel in a taxi? Just lots of little things everywhere for the eye to jump to. It's like, oh, there's a little thing. Oh, there's a little thing.
Yeah, I mean, this is one that I stare at a lot. I mean, I love bright lights, coloured lights. you know, I'm sitting in a room full of hue lights that I can have dancing colors, and I do when I just feel like it. But all the different lights and shapes, and you know, yes, the light trails were the point, and I mean the cars did beautifully by staggering like that for me.
Yes, nice of them.
Yeah, but realistically, that's kind of just a nice part of the photo, and the photo really is look at all of these pieces of nighttime Singapore.
Yeah.
And it was very much a memory for me because, you know, we obviously spent quite a bit of time in that room when it was dark. But yeah, we would not pull the curtains at night and we would just sit there. And if you couldn't sleep, like the first night when you had a bit of jet lag still,
yeah,
and you woke up at a ridiculous hour, you could just hop out of bed, go sit, and they had a little cushion by the window. You could sit on it and just stare at that. And I can still do that today.
Yeah.
Then we went on to Japan, and this thing, goodness me, this was the thing I was looking forward to the most because it was an organized tour and there was a brochure. And when I saw this in the brochure, I thought, oh, wow. And that was my top item. And the zoomed in area here is just part of this. It's called Kinkaku-ji, or the Temple of the Golden Pavilion. That is actually gold leaf.
Whoa.
20 kilograms of gold leaf covering two floors of this shrine.
Wowzers. And
the editing there, I spent forever getting the color of the foliage looking natural because the what the camera did to it wasn't great.
The sky is a gold bit of a, might have confused the yellow white balance a bit.
Yeah. But the key thing for me was to get that gold across. I mean, there's
the white
there,
is white, Alistair.
But the detail's not important. The white is white, yes. Well, almost. But there's certainly some dark and light in that bottom story that doesn't have the gold. But it, you know, in person, it is absolutely stunning. It did not disappoint me. It's, you know, it was my top thing that I was looking forward to seeing, and it absolutely delivered in spades. So the thing that I got extremely lucky with was that I got one shot, this one, no people in it. Because I tell you what, this was not a place where you thought, oh, I'm going to take some photos and I'm just moving over here a bit. No, it was thronged with people. They were, you know, you had to wait your turn to get to the fence to be able to take a photo without heads in front of you. So I just took a series of shots.
It just looks tranquil. Yeah. The fact that you had to jostle to get there is wonderfully obscured by the magic of photography.
Yeah. As I say, I got lucky. I've got lots of other photos, just slightly different angles, and you'll see people in white T-shirts.
Yeah.
So sort of through gaps in the trees or around on a path further around and things like that. And if you recall Alison Sheridan's travelogue when she went and saw this, and they were looking for the lightning rod that's up there, I believe.
There it is. Yeah. Yeah, actually, and just to underline the importance of a careful, deliberate edit, I think the fact that the white balance is right to get the green contrasting with the gold and the white looking white, I think that's why the image sings.
Yeah. But yeah, getting that gold just right. You know, the number of times that I sort of did it, I thought, right, that's it. And then I, you know, did the export and I looked at it and I thought,
nope,
not gold enough. And then I do another edit and I was like, that's too yellow. And then I do another edit. And it took me about five or six goes. You know, I spent a lot of time getting the foliage looking natural at the beginning, but I had about five or six different versions of that gold before I was happy with this one.
Well, it works. It's time well spent.
It's on the outskirts of it's on the outskirts of Kyoto. If you go to Japan, go visit it. It's absolutely stunning. It's arguably hundreds of years old, but in fact, this is at least the third rebuild of it. The last rebuild was in the there was a monk. Nobody actually goes inside it apart from maintenance, but there was a monk who lived in the wider shrine who had mental health problems, and he decided it was too perfect, so he set a match to it. But it is a faithful reproduction of the version that came before, because during the Second World War they were afraid of these precious treasures being bombed, and they sent people around to document these treasures to incredible levels of detail. And so when it came time to rebuild it in the late 50s, early 60s, they had all this detail to go on. And they originally put 2 kilograms of gold leaf on there, and it kept falling off, so they ended up with 20 kilograms.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like I say, this photo doesn't do it justice by a mile when you actually see it in the bright sunshine. And this was the day I got heat stroke, so it was nice and bright.
Okay.
Yeah, after going here. Okay, and moving on to another photo in Japan, and this was, I know Alison said she loved the Japanese gardens, and we went to this one. And the photo here is, it's kind of not about the detail, it's about the expanse of the grass and, you know, well, getting those lines like that.
The two ladies with the umbrella, because even from the thumbnail, the two ladies with the umbrella bring the scene to life. It's these very gentle, beautiful lines and these just nice shapes in the abstract, and those two ladies.
I do wish the other 10 people weren't in the scene, though, because if it was just those two, because they were almost
that
in
is
the foreground.
Fair.
And if I had the time, and this was the problem with the tour, is that we never really had much time anywhere. If I had the time, I would have stayed there and taken multiple frames. And then just composited them so that I had real photographic, you know, content. Control. But, you know, where the people are on the left, I would have used a frame that didn't have people on the left and so on. And just I would have just left those two ladies in there. And I might have picked a time when that person behind them wasn't right behind that umbrella. But, you know,
right.
But this was, it was, I was trying to just capture, I mean, there's the Black Castle in the background. That's what they call it. I think it's just called the Black Castle. So that sort of pops up from behind the trees, and it's something of interest, which is why I sort of just popped it right in the middle there, but it's not taking over the scene. The scene is really this beautiful, vast expanse of grass, amazingly kept, and the, you know, the water on the left and the trees in the background masking the castle. And this garden was originally built by the local shogun in 1700.
Wow.
And it has remained largely unchanged since 1863. So there's history in it as well, but it's a stunning thing to walk around. I wish we'd had more time there. So, yeah, this one, it was kind of a pick a moment. Oh, that's a beautiful view and take the shot. But most of this was in the edit, getting that sky right, which is still not perfect. There's sort of ghosting of where the trees were masked, which I'm not quite happy with, but that's kind of pixel peeping.
I was going to say, you're definitely pixel peeping, because I'm looking at it here on a big screen, and it's pretty darn good looking.
Yeah, it's really in places like this tree just to the left of the castle. Some of the gaps there of the sky are too bright because I had to bring the trees up a bit. And I hadn't masked it perfectly, or rather the AI hadn't masked it perfectly.
I was just going to say, yeah, but trees, they're just particularly evil.
Yes. So that's the four that that I will sit and stare at. I mean, there are others as well. I mean, I've got that sunset photo from the airport as well as one of the ones that I look at. And so those are just four examples that I thought were worth going into in some detail as to, you know, the amount of effort. So the buildings was a lot of effort in the photographing and a reasonable amount of effort in the editing. The night scene out the hotel window was a task of capturing the light trails, but making sure that I had interest in the rest of the scene. And in fact, the rest of the scene took over that photo. The editing, there was some careful treatment of colors in there to make sure that the dark bits stayed dark and yet the lights popped. The photo of the Golden Temple was like, take your shots and see what you get, because you don't get much chance there. But
yeah,
very, very careful editing of the colors on that to try and recreate what I saw. And then the gardens, again, was sort of a take your shot. I mean, I could have spent some time there, but it was a big garden and we, you know, walked around a big chunk of it, and we had a time that we had to be back at the coach. So it was just kind of, oh, that looks quite nice. But then again, when editing, getting the grass the right color was important there. Also the trees just didn't look right until, I mean, I had about three versions of that. And that one was an example where I looked at the thumbnail and I thought, the trees are just wrong in the thumbnail. And it took me a long time to actually figure out how to get the trees to actually look right, sit in the scene, look natural.
Yeah, it works.
And part of success is that, you know, you get people saying, oh, look at this cool wallpaper. I mean, there's companies online who produce these cool wallpapers that they give away for free. And they are cool and they look really amazing. And I used to use that sort of thing. I don't anymore. Here's what I randomly pick from on my phone. In fact, I've actually got way more than this. But these are some of my favorites. You'll see the Golden Temple is one of them. Now, I'm not editing these for the phone. In some cases, I've gone and created a new vertical edit where I've cropped it quite specifically, but you can kind of do that when you set it up as a lock screen.
Yeah, you can move it around.
Slide it around and zoom it. So I haven't really done a lot to make them fit for a phone screen.
Rather, I think there might be a selection effect there, Alistair, because I think they're subjects that are happy to be cropped in that very vertical way.
Yeah, and you know, of the nine shots there, you can see the bottom five are all birds. And in fact, numbers, you'll see the numbers have popped up there. Numbers 1 and 7, I've actually got, at the moment, I've actually got quite close in. And partly it's because I've just grabbed my standard watermarked versions, and you can see the watermark if you zoom out too much. But the sort of village weaver on the left, the bright yellow bird, absolutely love that shot. And there's a memory behind that was special. It was in a bird park in Singapore, and my wife at one point, we'd arrived at a spot in this giant walk-in aviary where there was a keeper there who was about to do some feeding and give a talk. And so all these birds showed up, these beautiful birds. And I was looking around trying to photograph as many as I could. And I think I found, was it 11 different species that I've got photos of in that one spot.
Wow.
And at one point, my wife looked at me and she said, are you okay? And the only word I got out was overwhelmed, because I was just so, it was just such an amazing thing with all these beautiful birds showing up in this one spot. And, you know, we just happened upon it at the right time. So that's a memory. And, you know, these beautiful bright yellow birds, yellow is my favorite color. The one on the far right is the bird park. The one on the far left was taken at closed a couple of years after we were there, and they opened a replacement one, and that one, number 9, was taken there. In fact, I have a photo of that, possibly the same bird, but certainly the same species in the old park as well, but it's just not as beautiful a photo. That one loves being vertical,
because it's
perched on a nearly vertical, what's that, bamboo stalk or something similar, and it's just a riot of yellow, which, as I say, it's my favorite color.
Well, I mean, 7 as well is perfect for vertical. And with the reflection in 3, that one really speaks to me.
Number 3. Both of those, complete luck. Number 3, I deliberately went out to my favourite birding spot on a local tidal inlet. I got there before the sun was up. And so this royal spoonbill was just sitting there, just resting as the sun rose and hit it. And that's one of those cases where, I've raised the shadows on its back so that you can actually see some feather detail there. But it is shadow because there's this bright sun lighting it from directly in front. Shortly afterwards, it walked off. So I just got lucky at the timing. The kingfisher in number 7, I spied it on this stick, and it actually looks better when it's further back because there's this big long stick and behind it is just blur of water with reflections of houses on the other side of the water. So it's this beautiful smooth background. But that was the only angle I could get because there's a kingfisher there, and there was one gap in the trees where I could get a clear shot of it. So that was the only angle I was getting, but I made sure that the edit came out nice and clear like that.
Yeah, it looks gorgeous.
Number 6 is special too. That's a couple of years ago. I took a holiday in the top of the South Island of New Zealand, and I drove that road, which I hadn't been on for 40 years.
Yeah.
We used to go. I had an auntie who lived basically behind me by probably 15 or 20 Ks in that photo. And I decided I was going to drive this road. I mean, it wasn't on the way to where I was going, but I thought I'll do it and then double back. And I stopped at this spot because I turned onto this road and I thought, oh, yeah. And it was exactly as I remembered it. I had this picture in my mind for 40 years, and I turned the corner and it's like, oh, yep, I know that's exactly it. Where I am. So cool. I stopped there, and I was actually looking for photos of a river that's just down to the right of that photo, but it was a pretty ratty-looking river, and you couldn't really get close to it. And then I turned around and saw that view. Yep, that's it.
Yeah, no, it captures a real sense of a journey. It's something very pleasing about that sweep of the lines.
Yeah, I mean, the road is the anchor of the photo. That, you know, it's going through this landscape, but the landscape is so tall and imposing,
right?
And layered. It was a pretty average day. It was drizzling most of the time, but that actually, I think, added to it.
Yes.
And number 5, another bird shot that's in our local eco sanctuary, and that's what I call a cozy shot. It's beautiful soft colors. It really teased out. I mean, it was super dark because it's basically forest, which is a real challenge for getting the photos. It was super dark, and I spent so much time teasing out detail without, you know, raising all of the problems with noise and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but I just love the soft colors on that one.
It's very gentle. It's like an evening wallpaper.
Yeah. And I mean, the number 8 is the hotel in Singapore, but it's an angle that not many people take a photo from. Yeah. I just turned around as we were walking past one night and thought, oh, that looks interesting with the way that lighting is done. And that's actually the one I use when I'm on call, when I'm, you know, potentially lighting up the phone screen in the middle of the night.
Yeah, it won't blind you too much.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then not only do I have, in fact, more than 9 now, not only do I have tons of my own photos on the phone screen, but the photo face on the Apple Watch got good in, I think it was the one before watchOS 26, whatever that was, 11 or something or other. Yeah. Previous to that, it was a bit weird, but not the current release, but the one before, they fixed the photo face, and you can do things like the size of the time there. By default, it will figure that out for itself, and it generally makes good
pretty
decisions.
Well.
But what I discovered recently that you can actually go through each photo on the watch app on your phone and actually change. I'll put the time here and use this size and this style and whatnot.
Nice.
I don't actually have this set on my watch right at the moment because I had a technical issue where I couldn't change them. And in the process of changing them, I managed to completely delete the whole lot.
Oopsie.
So I've had to go back to scratch.
They look great, though.
I should use these screenshots to find them all. And, you know, I mean, you can see on number 7 on the right there is that bright yellow Tabata Golden Weaver again. Yeah. Number 8, I kind of like. That's just everything Singapore. It's got the Merlion on the side spouting its water and the iconic hotel behind it.
Right.
Numbers 10 and 12 were in that original bird sanctuary. Number 3 was a memory. We were in the newer bird sanctuary and we got totally rained out. It just started pouring down. And I was with my sister and my mum at the time, and mum said, well, this will be for the rest of the day. And by the way, she was right. It finished at 5 o'clock. But as we decided, you know, well, we'll exit the park, and you sort of walk down the middle, and my sister said, oh, look at these flowers. And my mum and my sister's approach to photography is, oh, Alistair's got the camera.
Fair. Yeah.
Which is fine. And it was like, oh, look at these beautiful flowers. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. And I was taking a photo of this flower, which is a parakeet flower. And I was just sort of, I don't know what I was doing. I wasn't looking through the camera at the precise moment. And my sister goes, oh, what's that? And this beautiful, it's a crimson sunbird. So this is not a bird that's captive in one of the aviaries. This is just a local. Showed up on this beautiful flower in the rain. I mean, if you look at the bigger image, you can see the raindrops on the flower and the leaves. And the bird looks slightly bedraggled.
Just
this beautiful bird showed up on this amazing flower.
Yeah, lovely.
And number two is kind of...
I was going to call out number two, Alistair, because it's the perfect minimalism, and that layering is just stunning. And I presume the Apple figured out that the 17 should slightly hide behind the hill. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it doesn't always work, but if it's kind of obvious like that, it does. And I do love the way that it hides the numbers like that. I think it does a better job on the phone lock screens, but yeah, that is a good one. That's an iconic lake not far from that road shot that we looked at on the phone. Again, just this misty day, so you couldn't actually see really... I mean, you could see the tops of those big, tall hills, but it's just the way that they meet, you know, almost at the water. And there is more water beyond what you can see. It's just, you know, it's blocked by the crossing of those two slopes as they hit the water, and the fact that they're almost symmetrical and yet layered just adds to
gorgeous.
It.
Gorgeous.
And then, so these are things that I look at all the time. Is, you know, I've got my studio display or the MacBook screen. I've got the phone, which is probably the one I see the most, and I just constantly swipe between them depending on my mood. But there's a handful of photos that get printed, and I'm not great at printing yet, but I'm trying to do more. And yeah, I've got blank walls. And this photo is probably the epitome of everything we've talked about. And that is I've spared you my wall. It's a disgusting shade.
Yeah.
But that is a photo of a framed print that is hanging just to my right. Yeah, and if I spun my screen around, well, you'd be able to see it. So the learnings there, I went out, I had two training courses that I'd done. One was on wildlife photography and one was on editing wildlife photos. And this used lots of it. One of the things was backlighting is often quite
challenging.
What's the word I'm looking for? Well, it is challenging, but it's also interesting. And so, but the first part of it was, this is another royal spoonbill, and you'll often see them in that there's about, I think there's about 17 or 18 of them around that hang around this year. This was a couple of 1 or 2 years ago, but I went out there early morning, and one of the things in the photography course was learn the behavior of your subject. And so I went to this area where there's a tidal pool that various species of bird tend to hang out in, particularly in the mornings and the evenings. And there was about three of them there. And I was sort of looking at them thinking, not a great photo. And then one of them took off and I thought, ah, I missed it. Well, hang on a minute. If one took off and went that way, probably another one is going to sooner or later. And it was probably 5 to 10 minutes later. So I just stood there and I waited and thought, one of them's got to come sooner or later.
Right.
Sure enough, it took off. It flew right across in front of me. And I took a whole bunch of frames. I mean, I wasn't rapid firing at the time. I was just sort of picking my moments. And, yeah, I just took a whole bunch of frames. And this one sort of jumped out at me with the wing position, the scene behind it. It is cropped. If you go up to about where the black frame is, there's a road with a car on it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, so I can't tell. I've
cropped it in to get, you can kind of get a sense that the vegetation ends there because there's some slightly different colors coming in. So waiting on the behavior of the bird, thinking, well, if one went that way and there's three more of them over there, others are probably going to go that way. Yes, they did. I knew it was going to be backlit. So I lowered my exposure to make sure I didn't blow out the light through the wings. I mean, there's a slight blowout on the tip of the beak, but that actually kind of makes it.
I was going to say, that's almost a highlight. That's a feature, not a bug.
There's even water drops just coming off the feet there.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of water visible in the bottom with the little spiky grass in front. And the colour of that foliage, which is basically swamp grasses, I forget the species of it, and something else in the middle there to make it slightly interesting. Spent a lot of time on that. But you can see how the light sort of comes in from the top, that's sort of coming in behind the bird. That's not directly on the frame that was captured. The frame was actually pretty flat. But one of the teachings of the course was, if the light was coming from a direction, emphasize that. And you can see the light through the far wing, and the fact that the near wing is kind of in shadow. So the light was coming from sort of upper left of the frame. So there is a deliberate brightening and warming of that top corner to show you that the light is coming through from that corner. And as I said, considerable time spent getting the white balance right on that one.
Yeah.
And the most amazing thing about that photo for me is the chap who created the courses has every year he has a competition where you can put, there's 10 categories that he challenges you to do, and one of them is backlit. And
yeah,
I submitted it for that and it didn't get chosen. I didn't actually end up submitting anything else. But he then had a session where he said, send your photos and we'll do a live critique. And as with all these things, he ran out of time, but he quickly stopped on that and said, I've kept a recording of what he said. And he said, oh, beautiful photo, the backlit, the white balance is perfect. I love the thing on the beak at the front. And it's just like, okay, it was your course that got me there and you like it. So
yay.
Success.
It's the detail through the wing. I just adore the gentle feel of that background. It just feels of mourning. It feels of action without drama, if that makes sense.
It's graceful. I mean, that wing position, yes, I think makes it graceful. And they are graceful birds. It's a relatively slow wing beat, and they just sort of lumber into the air.
Yeah.
I've got photos of the landing, which are quite hilarious.
The tip of the wing where you can, the air is almost made solid by the shape of the wing. Yeah. Okay, that wing is working against something real. It's actually air.
You can actually see the curve in the near wing as well, but it's not as obvious.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's literally, and, you know, could I produce that photo 2 years ago? Probably not. Would I have even taken it? Or would I have thought, oh, I missed it, and then walked off and looked for something else? Probably. If I had been lucky and got the photo, would I have thought to do the emphasis of the light and really pay attention to, you know, getting that white balance? You know, that near wing can easily look blue or look too warm, considering it's not actually lit directly. And, you know, even just the amount of detail, like the foreground grass on the near side of the water is quite sharp, but everything else behind it is just soft. And that was aided by reducing the contrast in those areas.
Yep. No, it's so, and a lot of the stuff you've learned is it's not in your face. It's lots of subtle things which together make the photo great. None of it is one big in your face. Oh wow! It's just no. The whole thing comes together with careful craft everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at it next to the original frame, it's quite stark. But, I mean, the original frame is a raw photo, which tend to be relatively flat in the first place.
That's how raw works. It's like, okay, you got to do the work afterwards.
Excellent. So yeah, that's kind of the one shot that encapsulates everything I've talked about. You know, I knew how to operate the camera. That was my previous camera. I knew how to operate the camera. I considered the behavior of the bird in order to get the shot at all. I took several and chose which one had the right positions. And then I spent some considerable time, you know, dealing with that light.
Yeah.
In all the different ways.
Alistair, thank you very much for that. We will most certainly be putting these slides up so that people can click along while they listen along. Thank you for thinking of me. And I'll message you separately, but I already have an idea for something I'd like to have you back on to talk about. So people may hear your voice again, certainly, hopefully, in less than 8 years or whatever we said it was.
Nine.
Okay, goodness me. Yeah, certainly less than that. We do have some time zone challenges, but I definitely have a conversation I'd like to have with you. But I'll be in touch afterwards, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you again soon. But thank you so much for doing this and for thinking of us.
Oh, and thanks for having me. And when I say I had these courses and these are the learnings, I have to say some of the learnings comes from listening to you in your other episodes talking about some of these aspects. And it's like probably the courses that I did, it was like, oh, right, and that solidified something I already knew from listening to what you talked about. I mean, the perspective stuff, for example, isn't in the courses because they're wildlife specific. So yes, okay. It's a collaboration ultimately. And yeah, the final slide I've got up there now is my Flickr URL, which is, I mean, basically 99.9% of the photos that ever get published anywhere go on my Flickr. Yeah, I've got 6,000 or some 5,000 or 6,000 up there so far that go back to 2005 or 6. And then the bottom URL is just my personal sort of landing page site that will link you also to Flickr, but also to the I've got a bird focused site and an aviation focused site as well where I post photos.
And everywhere on the internet, if you come across a ZKARJ, it's Alistair. That is his very unique little five letters.
Yep. And if you go to the aviation site, you'll see what the origin of that is.
Yes, because it has a backstory, a wonderfully aviation backstory.
Yep. The link is The Legend of ZKARJ.
Excellent. Okay, the slides and everything will be at letstalk.ie. Thank you again, Alistair.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed listening to that conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. A big thank you again to Alistair for doing all of the legwork here and for basically pitching me a complete show idea. What a wonderful way to spend a Wednesday morning chatting to Alistair. You will find Alistair's photography on his Flickr profile, which is at flickr.com/ZKARJ. And you can find all of Alistair's links on his personal landing page at zkarj.me. That's .me. I've been your host, Bart Bouchotz. You will find, again, detailed show notes, including a link to the presentation that Alistair talked through on letstalk.ie. While you're there, you will also notice big buttons to support the show. A giant big thank you to everyone who ever has supported the show in any way, be that financially by using one of those big buttons on the website, or simply by spreading the word online or in person among your friends and family. Every bit of support is helpful, every bit of support is appreciated. And again, you may have noticed that there were no ads, no sponsors. That is because this show is 100% listener supported. You guys all rock. Again, show notes at letstalk.ie. I've been your host, Bart Bouchotz. You can find me at bartb.ie. And until next time, happy snapping. Thank you.